Right, let her rip. Welcome to the Presidio Bitcoin Jam.
Woo-hoo.
How you guys doing?
What's up, guys?
Hey, DK. Hey, Mac.
Hey.
Hey, guys.
So we're two of the three of us are in the Presidio right now, but we decided to do the show remote because I think we're all either sick or, you know, likely to become sick or something. So how are you guys feeling?
On the path to recovery.
Okay. Yeah, I'm feeling pretty good. I was just saying an unusual situation, you know, holding down the fort here in the Presidio. But I was telling DK I wanted to save this story. I have a newfound appreciation for San Francisco, and here I'm chugging a little bit of an electrolyte solution I made with salt and water. I've been on the road for the last week and a half, also just got back super late last night, and for the first time in my life, we went out to New Mexico for a visit to the Santa Fe Institute, which that, by the way, is its own interesting rabbit hole we should chat more about, but Santa Fe Institute was founded by a Nobel laureate from Los Alamos, and they basically study complexity. Very, very, very interesting place. Really interesting work there. And I've always thought of like complexity, and in many ways, is like the basis for sort of like investing. Like investing is sort of like applied complexity theory. Anyways, that was very cool. But it's a lot hotter in the desert, and there's a lot of elevation. And I continued to do my my normal sauna routine, and when the water fountain was broken. And all of those factors continue to add up. Also, we drove there and back, which you guys know I like never drive. So stacking
all San Francisco to Santa Fe
and back.
That's like, is that like a day or two of driving?
I have many. We've been on the road for over a week. It's been an experience. I'm good not driving for another lifetime. And anyways, it was interesting. It was fun. But yeah, man, I was driving. And after the sauna, we were driving out of New Mexico. And I came to a gas station. I was just like, I think I'm like kind of starting to lose consciousness. I need to pull over now. And so we did and got in there, called paramedics. And I was like, all right, if I, you know, shout out to Anjali. I was like, I'm trusting you to get me IVs. And if this is the end, this is the end. But anyways, they came. I got a lot of like nasty, nasty electrolyte solutions, but I drank them and I'm alive. Anyways, happy to be back in San Francisco. Happy to be back chatting with Bitcoin with you guys. Not be on the road, not be in the heat.
Yeah, well, we're glad to have you and you're still alive, which is good news. And I think we have the coldest summer on record. I think the coldest June on record in San Francisco since 2002.
Excellent.
So
love it.
Try to stay healthy, get more sauna time in the cold. When you're better, maybe we can
sauna for a while, I don't think. No.
Maybe when you're better, let me know, we can go sauna together.
All right. I love it. Steve, we'll get you in there too. It'll help with your cold as well.
Yeah, Steve's still never been to the sauna. What kind of podcaster are you?
I know, man.
I haven't checked all the boxes yet.
Okay, but at least you're starting. You have the Bitcoin Treasury company that you're going to announce that you're starting, right?
Yeah.
As any good podcaster would.
missing that check mark as well.
Right. I don't want to get announced in the sauna.
What do you bring into the conversation here? Come on. All you have is like technical knowledge and
it's gonna be a rocket ship, baby.
Going up. So in a more serious note, the news of the week. I think we missed last week because it was the 4th of July. So we've actually haven't convened in like a week and a half now. So we've got
that's why we're doing a special edition Wednesday.
Special edition Wednesday.
Because we missed all of last week and we didn't want to go two full weeks.
Yeah.
So now we're going to do one today and then we'll do one. We'll get back on schedule next week.
Yeah. So a week from Friday, we'll be back on regular schedule.
Yeah.
Cool. And I'll be in the studio. I don't know about you guys, but I'll be around.
I don't know.
Good.
If you'll have me.
We'll have you. If you've got your Bitcoin Treasury company ready to go by then,
yeah, exactly.
Invite it back. Otherwise, don't talk to us.
Real.
Well, it's more we need to investigate bacterial pneumonia, how contagious it is. Because I did not think it was contagious, but now it appears it is.
Right. Jen was worried and I said, I think it's non-communicable. And she got on ChatGPT and she's like, no, it's definitely communicable.
Yeah, we need some complexity scientists to check that out, Steve.
Yeah.
Okay, so the news of the week. I think we've got a few things that happened that are worth noting, and we can obviously take this in any direction. But I saw this $100 million venture capital raise by EgoDeath Capital, And my understanding, EgoDeath has been operating as a Bitcoin-only VC for several years already and made a lot of prominent investments. And so a new capital infusion of $100 million to back, I presume, is Bitcoin-focused company going forward. That's good news for the ecosystem, good news for Bitcoin, good news for the development ecosystem around kind of new startups in Bitcoin. Have you guys talked to any of the folks over there? Do you guys know much about kind of the plans?
Probably as much as you have.
Okay. So yeah. Just heard it on the news. Any favorite investments? I know they did Fetty.
I had pneumonia the past week, so.
Okay, see.
I hosted an out, station in Mexico.
My outreach was at zero the past week.
Yeah. Got it.
Yeah, I mean, I have a little bit of color on this. I mean, I haven't talked to them recently, but I mean, we obviously worked together on a lot of deals in the past. And I think it's interesting for a couple of reasons. And I would say Lynn is probably who I, you know, speak the most with. And a couple of other investments, you know, a lot of the same companies we've invested in, you know, they're focused on like a little bit later stage now. So like Breeze, you know, I invested early in them out of Hivemind, and then they led both a seed and now I guess Series A or kind of a larger round out of this new fund, I think, which is interesting. And a couple others, Fetty is one as well. We've also co-invested in. I think it's exciting because of two things. One, you know, just speaking from my own personal experience, when raising Fund 1 for Hivemind back in 2021, it was a very different environment. Interest rates were zero and people were watching Bitcoin rip through the moon. And so there was a lot of enthusiasm. And I think it was, frankly, a lot easier to raise money back then. I think a lot of companies and funds have, frankly, gone through a little bit of a winter for the last couple of years. And, you know, even with the price kind of ticking back up, it still obviously hasn't gone parabolic. So you haven't seen any of that kind of crazy euphoria that you saw back in 21. And so, you know, I think they put out a press release. They were starting to raise this around, I think, 2 years ago or something, a year and a half ago. So it's certainly been long raise, but seeing that complete is, you know, great because it's a sign that, you know, the tides are perhaps turning. And capital that understands Bitcoin, understands long-term trajectory of this, is also interested in the companies that are actually building on top, well, the infrastructure itself and then the applications on top of it. So I think that's a great sign. I think we're probably, my hope as well is that this is going to be a turning point, not only for the funds, but obviously downstream of the funds, the companies who are now able to go out there and raise their Series A's and Series B's and et cetera. I think the other thing that's interesting is the Bitcoin sort of focused ecosystem has very much lacked a Series A focused fund, also kind of Series B as well. So there's been, you know, a lot of capital at the seed stage, obviously like, you know, folks like myself at the pre-seed stage even that are going super, super early. But since, you know, Kraft used to do a sort of a lot of investing at this sort of Series A stage with companies like Lightning Labs, but over the last couple of years, something that I've seen and run into repeatedly is that there's a gap in the market of, okay, you know, this seed stage company has a little bit of traction. Now they need to go out there and raise, you know, let's call it $3 to $10 million to get to the next phase. And frankly, there really haven't been a lot of those funds. Crypto funds are not really focused on Bitcoin. Traditional VC occasionally will do some, like obviously, you know, Coastland Founders Fund with Lava, but that has not been the norm. So I think it's definitely a gap in the market. And, you know, I think this is going to be the first of many we see for new fundraises and for hopefully, you know, other traditional Series A funds as well coming in and starting to fill that gap.
And do they pretty exclusively focus on kind of traditional Series A, Series B, take a board seat, kind of larger checks? Like what's a typical check size, do you know?
Well, I think that's shifted over time. I mean, in their Fund 1, they did a lot of seed, or they were primarily seed focused as well. So I don't know exactly how their plans have evolved. I think they're definitely trying to do more in the few million dollar range, it looks like in the $1 to $4 or $5 million range. I'm obviously no insider info there. It looks like, yeah, I think a bit more traditional, trying to get a board seat and that sort of thing.
And would you pull them into like a seed deal you're looking at to also co-invest in seed, or do you feel like they're more like graduated beyond that scale?
Yeah, I mean, I you know, obviously don't know what the current state is. The press release that you shared, you know, said they have some seed money left. And so, yeah, I mean, definitely I've co-invested with them and, you know, would definitely consider putting them in for a seed round. I would say, at least for me, over time, I've gone even earlier. So now I'm much more in like, how do we get this one? It's just one or two guys or gals and get that absolute first money in. So I would say that's probably, you know, too early for them now, kind of where they're scaling up. I think in that seed round, where there's a little bit of traction, is maybe an area we would both play. But it looks like they're definitely trying to go a little bit later stage, which I think is great for the ecosystem.
Yeah. And it looks like, I think, from both what we saw at the Presidio Bitcoin hackathon, as well as just all of the energy we see happening around vibe coding, it feels like there's a lot of new ways to get started, in a sense.
Yes.
And I think my understanding is, I don't know if you're still in deep discussion here, but my understanding was that out of the Presidio Bitcoin hackathon, there was at least one, if maybe more, that, you know, proto companies or might be companies. You know, I'm just curious, sort of from where you sit, Max, did you end up investing out of that, or are you still pursuing that, or sort of what is the very earliest stage look like? Because I feel like the earliest stage from the Presidio Bitcoin hackathon and what we've seen in vibe coding is sort of undergoing a lot of changes right now. And I wonder sort of how that impacts your business, because you're like at the very earliest stage possible.
Yeah. I mean, so I have not invested in anyone specifically, anyone new. I mean, some of the hackers, obviously, like Lalu, or already founders of existing Hivemind workos. But I have not made any new investments out of that yet. There's one that I'm continuing to chat with. And I think it's not something that's going to happen overnight. But I would say that one's still in play. And we'll see where things go over the next month or two. I think, one thing that's maybe changed a little bit for me now is I view coming in as that first check is like, there's still a gap where, you know, maybe someone has a really good idea, but they want to be able to, you know, quit their job, or, you know, they want to be able to make one or two key hires or contractors. That's maybe the difference between, like just having a great technical product and having it look beautiful or something like that. So I definitely think there's still going to be, a lot of room for some of that really early money, sort of almost like angel money, which is I think really helpful to get started. But at the same time, to your point, you know, even if you don't get crazy revenue immediately, like I also as an investor do expect to see now with the advent of vibe coding tools, like I want to see some demonstration of traction, right? Like I may have a thesis that it matches, but you should be able to show some data points. It doesn't necessarily need to be revenue, but some data points like, yes, there is interest in this thesis that I'm putting out there.
Do you have any kind of requests for startups or things that you imagine should be built, but you haven't seen people building yet?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, on the taking a giant step back, because it's something I've been thinking about, as I'm putting together some more information for some of my LPs. And I would say, if you take a giant step back and you say, okay, AI is going to drive the cost of app development, you know, towards or asymptotic with zero. What is still scarce in that world, right? So I put on my sort of like Bitcoiner, like what's great for the world hat, and then I put on my investor hat. If I put on my investor hat, I'm like, what's actually scarce in a world where open protocols, things like Bitcoin, Lightning, and Nostr allow for, interoperability of data, interoperability of identity with Nostr, and plug into open payment networks. And now with vibe coding tools, like, okay, it's a lot of easy switching cost, especially if you can bring that identity with you with Nostr. So what's still scarce in that world? Well, I come up with like three major things that are still scarce, arguably four. One is obviously Bitcoin itself. So companies that are able to start stacking and building that stack quickly, that's very valuable. The second is human attention, of course, or the attention, let's say, of the entity that owns the capital. So not to be speciesist, perhaps that guys over times, but attention, which is in fact all you need. Attention is still a very scarce resource, but that's a little bit trickier, because then you're actually playing for like what's the thing that's going to get hot, and I think that could shift quickly over time, like films versus long-standing sort of getting trapped into a network like a Facebook or something. And so I definitely think there's always going to be investment opportunity to find what gets hot, whether that's an app, whether that's a podcast, like. Everything is competing for the same resource there, which is human attention. And so there's always going to be money to be made there. But I think that's going to be a lot more sort of like Hollywood-esque at this point. It's going to be a lot more projects that come quickly. Teams kind of get together. They make a lot of money on it if they do well. But then they break up and they, try new things. And I think that attention cycle is going to get faster and faster. So I think that's frankly hard to invest in now. Unless you have some like real strong thesis or alpha around that, I think that's tricky. The third thing though, and this is what I'm getting increasingly obsessed with, is the infrastructure itself. And man, we need to do a whole show on this, and potentially way more than a show, but I am I'm basically, as you guys know, longtime Solar Bull, longtime Solar Maxi, along with Bitcoin. And the deeper I'm getting in this right now, the deeper I'm seeing that, you know, the ability to build, like the demand right now for compute is literally insatiable. And one of the biggest limiting factors is energy. And there are some very wild ideas I'm exploring at the moment around, you know, that there's still all this old world thinking of like, well, we need to find a way to connect it to the grid and this and that. But if you follow, just follow the curves and see how much cheaper solar keeps getting reliably, how much cheaper batteries keep getting reliably. And you pair that with what I call sort of a new permissionless paradigm, which I think Bitcoin is definitely what kicked it all off, of like, oh no, we don't need, you know, potentially to connect to the grid. We can do everything behind the meter. We can literally not even sign contracts, but we know as long as there's a kilowatt hour produced, there is a buyer of last resort that pays for it. I think that paradigm is going to come more and more into the compute realm as well. So I am increasingly becoming obsessed with this idea that there are ways to build, you know, call it even like new grids that just like leave the whole old grid behind. And I think there's going to be tremendous, tremendous, tremendous opportunity for people who are kind of like big, wild thinkers out there. That obviously requires a lot more capital than I had to deploy, but I think, you know, there's still room for me in that early stage to help someone get that idea off the ground. But I'll have more coming on that, but that's an area I'm getting pretty obsessed with.
Yeah. And I mean, it seems like if you have a big idea like that, it doesn't need to necessarily fit your existing kind of capital structure, right? You could go raise new capital for something big and ambitious that's more focused on a particular venture, right?
Yeah, no, and I'm definitely exploring all that. So I think, you know, and again, I think a fourth area that scares we've all talked about is position in the Lightning Network itself. So I continue to be also very, very, very bullish on any company that, you know, ideally owns some, you know, human attention or some, you know, sort of network effect like Cash App or something. And I think a lot of the apps out there today do that, you know, or have the potential to do that. Things like Albi, you know, Breeze, which is really exciting, sort of the SDK adoption they're getting. And I do think that that position, the sort of railroad analogy we've used, is also very good. And I'm sure there's others I'm not thinking of. So to be clear, I'm still very bullish on a lot of the sort of traditional Bitcoin companies, but I think that, and you know, companies that integrate Nostr, but I'm increasingly thinking it's like using Bitcoin, using Lightning, using Nostr is going to become kind of table stakes. And so then the question becomes, where beyond that does value actually accrue and where is it potentially capturable? And I think some more of the actual hard infrastructure stuff is getting really interesting to me.
Yeah. Have we seen any kind of talent marketplaces on kind of Nostr? Anything experimented there that looks interesting to you?
Like LinkedIn or like, what do you mean?
Well, I was thinking maybe a little more Upwork.
TopTal. Like,
yeah, TopTal is a great example. Or like, yeah, kind of Upwork is a more open public one. TopTal's a bit more curated, but.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we've talked a little bit about, you know, Unstuck, which has the AIs hiring people. I think that's still like a kind of brand new model that could only exist on something open and permissionless like Nostr. I'm sure there are. I mean, honestly, the thing is, it's getting hard to track all the sort of like long tail experimental Nostr apps, which is great because that means we're seeing experimentation. Yeah, yeah. So if someone's in the chat and they know of one, I would, you know, bet money that someone has tried something in that direction, but nothing that's gotten big enough yet to really get on my radar.
Because I have a specific idea I was going to float I think touches on an idea that I think Steve and I have. I forget if this was in our main chat or kind of in a side chat, but I think when I was experimenting with the VO3 videos, so the videos that you can speak, I think Steve had played around a little bit and kind of was like, I can't get it to do what I want. Is that an accurate representation, Steve? And did you ever end up finding happiness with that or
not? or unhappiness?
I haven't invested more time in VO3.
Right. So this is kind of my point is I wouldn't consider myself a VO3 expert, but I have a little bit of a process that I can do. Like, so if Steve were to propose, hey, I'd like a video that helps me tell this story or uses this kind of script, I think I could take his input and use my knowledge is a little bit more advanced than Steve's to do some meta prompting and get a thing that Steve might like. And I want, it, in a sense, that it's not like a film producer because I'm not good at that. I'm not like a traditional filmmaker or video editor, but I do have some some amount of skill at VO3 video creation relative to the general population.
I think we might have talked about it on the show. I definitely remember talking about this with you, though. But I do think that's like a great job category. People who have leveled up their skills in prompting and then offered that as a service to others.
Yeah.
So I could see it in video production. I could see it in, you know, vibe coding. You know, it feels like there's a lot of opportunity here to sort of cross, you know, help people's ideas come to life, even if they can't fully prompt them. But other people who aren't traditional, in a sense, they're good at prompting, but maybe not good at the traditional creative process, actually is like a new type of supply or inventory you could bring online. And that when you're bringing new inventory online, that's sort of what usually gives rise to new marketplaces.
Yeah,
because you don't have people who are already entrenched and already know how they make money and do their craft. You sort of like enable new people. That's kind of the rise of Airbnb, for example, or the rise of, you know, Uber, is that concept. So I almost feel like that's a little bit of a request for a startup I would make. You know, and I wonder, is the right way to build that to start in a fully like permissionless Noster publishing the event and the needs and the jobs and build a client for that and then Bitcoin for payments? Or is it better to simplify the UX with a centralized thing with a view toward how you get it, like how you could get it into the kind of Noster Bitcoin ecosystem? Because there's sort of like a different use case needed, like independent of the censorship resistance of all of this, there's actually like a marketplace need, in my opinion anyway. Yeah. What do you think about it?
Well, can I make a suggestion?
Yep.
Not of that specific idea. First of all, I totally agree with that idea. I like it. But I know you have many ideas. Max does. A lot of us have entrepreneurial ideas. It would be great to like crowdsource those and create a list. It would be great to bring that to the monthly builder meetup.
Yeah.
For City of Bitcoin. Bring it up to global builder meetups. And then it'd be great to attract entrepreneurs to work out of Presidio Bitcoin.
Yes.
To work on some of those ideas. So it'd be good to like sort of institutionalize this so that we don't share a good idea in the show and then it sort of gets lost. So maybe give us an action item there to follow up on that.
That's a great
idea. So like, what is that? That's like a list that's published on Twitter or like part of the Presidio Bitcoin website or part of the builder meetup page? Or
yeah, I don't have a specific location in mind, so we had to figure that out. But I mean, for right now, at least write it down on a notepad in front of you.
Yeah.
But you know, ultimately, we'd want that to be a public published list that others could contribute to. So maybe it's on GitHub, but then auto published to a website that's more accessible. But I think the more meaty thing would be like then actively discussing it at builder meetups, or even better, actively vibe coding it. Someone vibe codes it ahead of time and then demos it at the builder meetup.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And there'll be venture capitalists in the room as well, right? So we could help matchmake as well.
I mean, it's kind of like YC has their RFPs as well. I think that, I think doing it super informally is great. And then maybe, you know, over time institutionalize like a couple of like, no, this is like the really, really big idea. You know, maybe that makes the Presidio Bitcoin website or something. I think it's, yeah, I love it.
I'm guessing you won't mind me sharing this, but another one of our mutuals, my guess is he'd love somebody to just take and run with it, but he may do it if nobody else. But he was sort of suggesting it would be helpful to have a little bit of like a product hunt like community where you could gather up all the vibe coded Bitcoin Noster projects and kind of see what people are launching and what's kind of bubbling to the top of interestingness. So I told him to start with a Stacker News territory, but I think he has ideas even outside of what maybe fit that mold. So
it's cool. I think the builder meetup can sort of facilitate that as well.
We should potentially consider starting a builder Stacker News territory. Maybe that would be a good place to have a discussion and some of the lists for each month.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like the fact that it already, you know, like Stacker News already has a Bitcoin centric audience and kind of all the, you know, Lightning Bitcoin payment stuff, and it's all kind of built. So you can kind of just show up and prototype it there. And then if you want to do more advanced stuff, you can kind of customize later.
Yeah. And the quality of discussion lately, I think, has continued to improve, which is something that I'm excited about. I do want to come back to that idea itself, though, because I think it's very interesting. And it's, you know, it's, we mentioned, I guess, 2 months ago now, 3 months ago. That moves quickly. But I remember, you guys remember, I was trying to vibe code an app, you know, still couldn't. I still also haven't put in the time to figure it out yet. So I'm, you know, now that I'm back in SF, maybe I will. But I also got frustrated. I was like, I can't one-shot this. It's, you know, a little too hard. And so I ended up putting out the bounty for 100,000 Bitcoin, Satoshis, whichever you prefer. And I ended up putting that out there, and I got a guy that built 80% of it, and I ended up, you know, giving him the bounty. I think there's, you know, two kind of interesting ways this could go almost. I mean, the beauty of doing it the sort of Nostr and Bitcoin way is permissionless, right? So what you get from just kind of doing it as like a raw bounty to help you with getting your prompts or something like that is, you know, you can work with NIMs, AIs, you know, people that don't have traditional whatever. For whatever reason, they don't want to have their government name listed. And so in this case, the account that ended up helping me was called Lemon. I have no idea who this was. I have no idea if it's a human, it's an AI. All I know is they built what I asked for and I paid them. And so I think that's kind of the strength of sort of the Nostr version of this. And I think that's where something like Unstuck, the AI marketplace really, really, but it doesn't have to be AI, but like the open-ended marketplace really sort of thrives in that environment because it doesn't discriminate. And so you could say, hey, I need help with these prompts or with whatever. And, you know, here's what I'm willing to pay, or, you know, name your own price. And, you know, humans and AIs can compete for that. So that's really cool. On the other hand, though, if I'm being sort of totally like short-term rational about this, I do think there's going to be another more sort of like handheld experience, which is like, hey, I don't just want a random prompt or like kind of like throw it out to the ether. I want to actually like find someone that has good reviews, like have them work with me as like a, you know, a friend, a co-pilot, whatever. And I think that probably would start better in a more centralized system that can have a little bit more sort of curation around it. So I think both opportunities would be cool.
And so do you think it's fine, like if somebody has an idea for how to get to that decentralized version, would you sort of typically advise them start with the decentralized stuff and figure out how it all works? Would you say start, you know, get the UX right in the centralized thing and then you can decentralize it later? Or do you think that's just like a trap and then people get stuck in the trap?
Depends on what you want to do. I mean, I think in general, my sort of intuition is like when people say they're going to decentralize later, they almost never do. I think there are a couple of cases where that's likely it will happen. Something like Stacker News, because I think, you know, Kian is so committed to his sort of principles or philosophy. I don't think it's impossible. I mean, I think if you're trying to build a big business immediately, probably centralized is still easier. And so that's awesome. If you're trying to demonstrate the power of the open protocols, and obviously, I think you can do something really cool with Nostr. But I would say in either case, be clear about what your intentions are and what you want to get out of it. And so, and if you're going to go the open protocol route and really try and demonstrate something here, do something that can only be done with Nostr, Bitcoin, and Lightning. And in that case, again, I think it comes down to, you know, opening the hiring field to anyone or anything. Whereas if you're going to go the more like prompt marketplace, I want someone to work with, hold my hand, that's probably a more curated human-to-human experience, I would guess, for now. But yeah, who knows?
Yeah. I think if you, my take on this, and I asked because I was curious if you kind of would lean towards this or not, but my take is that you actually can nail UX and use case very easily if you're like, if you have like the commitment to the principles of what you want to achieve. And I think like your example of like Kian and Stacker News, he's like fully committed to the principles. He's not like, how do I keep this thing and build my own, you know, juggernaut, you know, centralized thing. He's like, it's open source. I'm going to keep it centralized for now because it helps me kind of work through the problems and maybe get some more traction. But I think, you know, he would not keep it centralized as soon as he has a path or plan for how to get it decentralized. But he's sort of focused, I'd say, more on the centralized thing first. So I feel like that's a relatively healthy pattern that's mostly underexplored. Like people try to go full decentralized, sort out all of the challenging problems there while you still have challenging problems in like the core product and the UX and, you know, the kind of overall experience. So
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I was discussing this with one of the, a little bit of a different context with one of the postdocs at the Santa Fe Institute. And I think it's something that, you know, it's kind of like to abstract it away, like, is bottoms up or tops down better? And is anything really just bottoms up or tops down? And I think, you know, the takeaway from our conversation, because he's coming from a very different sort of place. He does a lot of like studying biology and just totally different world. Is one, you know, depends. Depends on where you are in the cycle of an organism or whatever level of abstraction you want to say is growth. Two, there's no such thing as fully bottoms up or fully tops down. Like you could argue, for example, that all of this sort of in our own reality emerged bottoms up. And yet out of that emergence has come, you know, sort of human centralized institutions at a specific time, moment in time. So which is it? It's both. And I think I would just say in general, you know, one takeaway for me is maybe I've leaned a little too much in the like, you know, you can see even from my shirt, like the sort of Noster, build it from the ground up, like embrace the chaos. And I still definitely believe that's the sort of the trend of our sort of society, if it's going to be a free society, needs to follow that for sure. But I do think perhaps I've underexplored as well. And I think the Noster ecosystem as a whole, where centralization to test something out, to get it right, can be really good. And that's why, you know, you've seen some companies, things like Primal, like that there are clear advantages to having a small team, very focused with a point of view saying, no, we're going this design and, you know, ideally embrace as many of the sort of open principles as possible so they can, you know, not accidentally create their own protocol and still the system open. But we've said this many times in the show. I think one of the things Noster as a community lacks, we have the talent, we have the principles, we have a lot of ideas, but it is like very focused entrepreneurs who could come in and say, this is a beautiful idea, but I'm going to, you know, centralize enough to get a really incredible user experience out there and use Noster where it's valuable, but not just because it's an ideology. So I think if anything, I should probably steer a bit more in that direction myself.
Yeah, I think if you can understand the intention of the person, I think that sometimes is better than the specific implementation of the V1 and getting a V1 out there and getting traction is really, really challenging with anything new. So, you know, sort of pick your battles in a sense. And I think Primal is another good example where I think they've taken some heat for like their caching layer, which has some centralizing effects. But I think they're like, look, this solves the UX. This makes it much better. And like, it's open source and maybe it's still a centralized risk, but I think they're threading the needle pretty well on that, I'd say.
I agree. And I do want to add one very important caveat, which is, you know, you do have to understand what your principles are. And from every, you know, person's perspective, it's different and what really matters. And I would say, you know, in this whole ecosystem of the things we care about and are pushing forward, there are certain things where you just can't sacrifice on decentralization. That's why we all got into Bitcoin and focused on Bitcoin and did not get swept up with the crypto hype or, you know, the Ethereum and all the other stuff that came after it is, you know, at that base layer, there is no room for compromise. Because if you allow a trend towards centralization, which every other ecosystem has over time. And, you know, there's always plans of, well, we start decentralized and then we centralize or vice versa. We start centralized and decentralized, which has happened, oh, I don't know, never. Then you lose the whole principle of the technology that we're building on. So I think one thing I would encourage myself and, you know, the Bitcoin and Noster communities to think a bit more about is, you know, centralization and decentralization can be different and should be different at different layers of the stack. At the core protocol level for Bitcoin, there is no room for compromise. At the application layer, there's probably a lot more room for centralization while still respecting the base protocol.
Yep. Cool. Before we move off the topic of kind of building new things and venture capital and startups, I was going to mention that I just happened to be texting with a friend who's a staunch Bitcoiner, but not necessarily super involved in the San Francisco startup scene. And he sent me a link to Horizon. And he was like, hey, this looks really cool. Have you ever heard of this? And I was like, well, actually, those guys, you know, worked out of Presidio Bitcoin. You should come by. So I was just going to ask if you guys have heard any update on what's happening with Horizon. And I pointed out, is it Sovana? Is that the way you say it? the other one, Steve?
Yeah.
Savannah. So do you guys, that seems like an idea that just has organic, promising traction and kind of bridges some of the TradFi primitives that people are comfortable with kind of a use case for getting more involved in Bitcoin as people are learning about it. Have you guys heard anything about either of those companies and kind of market progress on them? Anything that you can share?
No, I haven't heard anything in the past week or so.
Yeah, I mean, nothing new to share. I still need to do a deeper dive into both. I mean, the one thing that maybe as an overarching principle is very clear to me, and we've discussed on the show before, is that, you know, where Bitcoin is in its own sort of adoption cycle, it's clearly in this sort of like securitization slash recapitalize old financial systems phase. And so increasingly, that's why I see sort of like the, I think it's undeniable, like the crazy market demand is to find ways to recapitalize a system that otherwise is failing under the weight of its own sort of fiat excess. And, you know, I know we've talked a lot about a lot of the treasury stuff on here and my own views on, you know, MicroStrategy versus the rest of the companies. But I think this is just another example where it's clear that there is demand, there's realization that Bitcoin is pristine capital and pristine collateral. And there is demand in the largest markets, traditional capital markets in the world, that we can introduce flavor of Bitcoin to, in many ways, I would say, offer upside to the early investors there, but also to perhaps save a system that doesn't have to go down in flames, but can kind of transition much more peacefully to the next thing. And the real estate market obviously is massive as well. And there's clear demand to use Bitcoin to slowly insert itself and recapitalize that market too.
Cool. Okay. Well, I guess I indicated we might move beyond building, but I think our next topic is actually also about building, as many of the things that interest us are about. Have you guys have heard of this Skibidi project, Skibidi Cash?
I had to Google all that this morning, man. Like, I've never even heard the word Skibidi. I feel old.
What? Come on. We're like, Steve and I are way older than you. And We've already been discussing this, and I think there's a whole list of Gen Z words that we've recently educated ourselves about. But does anybody want to take the lead on what is Skibidi Cash? Kind of what's the whole process around this?
I understand it at a high level. I think Pavlenex proposed this. It's basically a hackathon. Heap just pooled, I think, his own money together, and then Matt Velez helped join as well. They put some money together and said, hey, anyone who builds a Skibidi app has a chance to win. And they gave out, I think, like $8,000 in prizes to the top three. And yeah, I'm not a Skibidi expert, but like the young generation is just basically like weird ass shit, like is attractive. And I looked at the top three winners, and the first place and third place, I noticed they both had toilets as part of their UI.
Yeah, me too. What is
going on? So when I say like they like weird ass shit, like almost literally. You know, I think it's just a new style or genre or whatever. It kind of makes me think back to 4 years ago, makes me think about like Dogecoin and these coins that play off of memes like dogs and Shiba and stuff like that. And then 4 years ago when interviewing Elon Musk, like he's like a reason he likes Dogecoin over Bitcoin is the most entertaining outcome will be the actual outcome is what he said in the interview. And I pointed out that like, why can't Bitcoin wallets or Bitcoin applications have skins or themes that are like cultural or fun or weird or whatever, right? And so I kind of like this contest to just like slap on super weird or culturally relevant user experiences for a very different demographic, but the underlying thing is a wallet or an application that lets you send and receive Bitcoin. So I think I thought it was a really unique, cool hackathon idea.
So not to be the total old head in the group now, I learned that word recently as well, but what, like, if you had to give just the TLDR, what does skibbity mean? And like, I noticed there's like, DK, perhaps you have some context because you know the toilet thing, or you mentioned that as well. Like, I saw a head in a toilet in 2023. Like, imagine most of our audience probably has never heard of this.
What's going on? I don't claim to be Gen Z, but I think skibbity means like trash or like crap or something. It just means like junk.
Like, is it a positive or negative? Because I quickly sort of Googled around this and was like, well, you can use it either way, but...
It's kind of like, that's bad. That's bad.
Like, that's skibbity. Like, as an example, would you say something like, oh man, like, okay, you know, the fact that my whole collapse in New Mexico happened, I'd be like, yeah, it was so skibbity.
Maybe, I don't know. You should update your TikTok knowledge if you want to get more culturally attuned.
I have zero plans to get on TikTok.
My understanding is that Matt actually did a bit of cultural research with the age demographic, and I think skibbity is like, it's very much like, you know, the meme of like, hello fellow kids. it's a little bit, I think, past its prime as a term.
But didn't he say he learned, I mean, it's isn't part of it everyone's self-aware of how ridiculous it is,
yeah,
and that's what makes it funny to them,
yeah,
but then it quickly becomes tiresome, whatever the current one is. But then the kids who are 2 years younger then think it's cool.
Interesting.
And then a little bit later, the kids 2 years younger than that think it's cool. But the older kids have already moved on to the next.
Yeah. So like if say like the 18-year-olds or the 16-year-olds kind of invent a new thing, then that's funny for a little while. This is from Matt's kind of ethnographic research. Then the 15, the 14 and 15 year olds hear about it and they think they're like in the cool kid game, like the kids a couple of years older than them. And then by the time it gets to the 12 year olds, the 16 or 18 year olds are like, this is no longer interesting, right? We got to come up with something.
Which is a pattern that's existed throughout time, but I think it's just like it's way faster cycles now.
Yeah.
Like probably in the matter of weeks or days, they go through new ones. You know, because combine that historical pattern that's happened with teenagers with internet speed, with memes,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they've just like accelerated all of that.
So this brings up so many questions and topics, right? We could literally spend a whole show just now on skibbity and Gen Z. But one thing, I mean, so this is kind of what I was referencing earlier when we were talking about the investing point. You know, of like what's scarce in this world. And one of the things is human attention, but like, it's really hard to think about, you know, the staying power of an application, because to your point, Steve, like it's accelerating faster and faster. And so like, what was the cool thing, you know, yesterday, tomorrow may be totally gone. So that's a very challenging environment to quote unquote invest in. And it also makes me just wonder, I mean, I really feel like the old guy now, but like, is this the singularity? We're always wondering, like, what does the singularity actually look like? It just looks like it's just going to be skibbity on steroids and people swiping faster and faster. And like, you know, it feels like postmodern on steroids. Like, I don't know. And then I also think to myself, does it have to be this way? Right. Like, it's very interesting to me. And by the way, I think it's a badass idea. And I really hats off to people for reaching out, and like, it's some of the nicer designs I've seen in the whole Bitcoin space. So that's sick. But I think about it and I'm like, imagine a world like, you know, like my understanding is in China that they don't let the kids use TikTok, which, you know, you could have some interesting like thoughts around, wonder why they encourage American kids to do it, but not their own. And I think to myself, like, is it just the internet and this is just the normal sort of acceleration of technology and pace? Or is it like, no, like we went down at least so far a particular technological cul-de-sac where people, you know, thanks to advertising-based business models have just become so like attention hungry and ADHD and swiping. And like, you know, it doesn't have to be this way. Like, you know, potentially in a new technological world with things like Nostra, Bitcoin, Lightning, perhaps there's a lot more still patience and there's still things that spread quickly online because it's the internet. What do you guys think? Do I just sound old right now or like, I don't know.
I think everything, I mean, our whole lives, we have just been on this techno acceleration path.
Yeah.
It's not like it just started. It's like,
of course,
it's been going, but because it's accelerating, every new phase seems like, wow, it just got a lot faster than I could have ever imagined. And so I suspect, you know, you fast forward 2 years, 5 years, we're just, it's just like ludicrous mode, plaid. You know, you're just like, everything is just like.
Plaid? Is that a Gen Z word?
What? You don't know plaid?
It's a Spaceballs. That's a Spaceballs reference.
I'm both too.
Aren't you a big, I thought you were a big Tesla guy. Aren't you a Tesla fan?
I love Tesla.
So you don't know what plaid is?
Oh, so plaid. Oh, interesting. I didn't, never understood the reference because that's
Tesla,
like high end.
Tesla came out with ludicrous speed and then they came out with the plaid model. Both of those are Spaceballs references because they go to the speed of light to catch another spaceship and then they want to go, but they were behind. So they had to speed up. So they had to go faster than the speed of light. So they went to ludicrous speed.
Got it.
And then they unintentionally, I think, went to plaid.
God.
And at the point when they were plaid,
the emblem on the Tesla is plaid, which is exactly from the movie.
But to me, I'm glad we're doing this because I've always wondered. I thought that was like some like reference to like a net or a web, like Indra's web or something. I mean, I guess.
No. Have you ever seen Spaceballs?
No.
Okay, you have to see Spaceballs.
Well, I may have seen some clips from.
Imagine they're like in some, you know, the spoof version of the Millennium Falcon, and they just like went through hyperspace or whatever. Yeah. And they overtook whatever their goal was. And now they're just like leaning back and it's just like plaid all around, almost like they're in like a psychedelic trip.
Quick correction. It would be the Star Destroyer because it was Darth Vader.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yes. Okay. It wasn't the Millennium Falcon.
They were catching the Millennium Falcon, which is an RV with wings.
Wait, so right? What is that web-like thing you see on the back of those Teslas that are plaid?
That's meant to be like a
literally
recreation
watch
of that
the movie,
scene.
Max. And they literally show that visual in the movie.
So, I mean, like, is that, I mean, yeah, I guess, like, is this sort of implication of all of that, that, like, we're realizing, like, our world is made of connections and information, and, like, that is the Matrix, a visualization of what it looks like.
I don't know the genesis of why they use that in the movie, but maybe. But what a comment I made yesterday, they just came out with a new version of Grok, and they renamed it from Grok to Super Grok, so I'm wondering when we get Ludicrous Grok. And plaid Grok. Although when Mecha Hitler came out yesterday, that might have elevated to ludicrous.
I was traveling today. I heard the word Mecha Hitler, but what is this reference?
Oh, you weren't aware.
I was traveling. I was not really online much.
So with this most powerful new version of Grok, someone broke it to like it Grok was telling everyone it was Mega Hitler and that Elon programmed it that way from the get-go.
was it like a joke or?
No,
it was a joke about Hitler, right?
The CEO left the company this morning.
Because of that?
I don't know. I don't, I wasn't part of the exit, so I don't know.
Right.
And Elon Musk cannot stay away from controversy. That is wild.
I mean, someone posted the diff. Someone posted the diff online of what, like they made a commit 16 hours ago to fix it. And I forget the exact details of that change, but they basically had to slap a filter on Grok.
Jeez.
Man. The world is just getting so great. And honestly, the more I think about it, like, I'm sure that's by design. Like, Elon's very, obviously, one of the smartest guys of our generation. Like, probably, like, this is what I'm saying. The attention cycle is getting so short. Those who understand how to really, like, keep getting in there over and over again, Trump does this, Musk, Elon does this. Like, they're going to do well in the internet age. But it's, I don't know, man. I guess I just feel old, but I'm like, this is... It's scary. And again, I mean, what do you guys think of my earlier question? Does it have to be this way? Like, if we have a much more, you know, kind of like quiet, sound, decentralized tech, like, does attention span still go to zero?
I mean, I think everything in the world is, excuse the reference, but it's a tick and a tock. Yeah. Mm. And so I think we're ticking really hard to the side of like hyper everything, hyper connected, shit posting everything, nothing matters, it's all nihilism. And I think the talk, which is only just at the frontier right now, it's not really a widespread mainstream thing, is to like the new luxuries are like, hell, and sleep and your time and being disconnected is, in a sense, a new form of luxury. It used to be a luxury to be able to be online a lot. Now it's a luxury to be able to be offline and to have relationships with real people instead of bots or whatever you're doing. Yeah.
Interesting.
So that's my take on it anyway. I think it's
so do you think that means as we go from the tick to the talk that, like, I don't know, like, and how long does this take to play out? Is like in a whole nother generation after generation alpha or whatever they are, that like people are actually like, no, we just like, we use the internet, but it's only like we have our, like, you know, our assistant that we talk to and it filters all of the crap for me. And like most of the time I'm like sitting in my, you know, whatever, in my garden or like talking with my like friends at school. And like the internet helps me, but it's not jacking my attention.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think the more that we have AI bots everywhere creating all of this content and you don't know what it is or who to trust, I think you naturally are going to be like, okay, I'm going to have my own bot to help defend me. And part of the defense is just organize and fish out the stuff that I should care about. And the rest of it, I'll just leave be because it doesn't serve me. Right. But that feels like it's kind of playing out now, but it may take years. I don't know. Depends on sort of the.
So to me, I mean, like you asked for requests for product experiences or things like, I want that. I want the best self-sovereign AI assistant that can filter out all the noise, be my like real co-pilot. And like, I don't want to have to use the computer anymore.
Yeah.
Ideally. And I think
like that, you want a voice interface probably, right?
I want a voice interface, but critically, and I think this is so important. You need to be able for that to work. And we've talked about this many times, but you need to know as much as humanly possible about the creation of that model or the agent, where it's hosted, who has access to it, because there's a 0% chance it's going to go well if a company is the one hosting that for you. Right. I mean, it's going to be like what happened with Facebook and the ads 1.0 or 2.0 on steroids. And so I think about, you know, if you could build one of the most important things for humanity today, who can do that in a way where you can audit yourself or have people that you trust audit to know what's in the model, who's hosting it. I think some of the stuff that, you know, people like OpenSecret or the companies like OpenSecret are doing, some of the encrypted stuff, that's a great first step. But who's going to create the sort of Apple of AI experiences? Maybe it will be Apple one day. Who's going to create the Apple of AI assistants? That to me seems like a very, like maybe the most important product you build.
Yeah, I do think there's, you know, there's this concept that people say, you know, generals fighting the last war.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of generals out there trying to fight the social media war. And the next war is going to be, you know, which AIs can we trust? And are they open source and in service of us or in service of some corporation? And we don't really know what that looks like yet. But I would almost say, instead of spending a lot of time fighting that last war, let's think about how to fight this new war, which is this battle for just even how our thinking works. Not the manipulated media thinking, but like the new form of, you know, artificial intelligence. Can we have open source and control and sovereignty? Because I think ultimately, like, you really go forward on this, I don't think we want humans making most of the decisions humans make today. We want to have like an agreed upon set of like rubrics for how decisions get made and how models get trained and what we're willing to ask them and what we're willing to accept as answers. I think that'll be a better version of the world when we get there. But I think we need to like really be thinking and experimenting with what that looks like. When we put our trust in systems that are going to help us make decisions.
And in order to put that trust, I think the absolute number one most important thing, which is why we're all, you know, into Bitcoin, Lightning, Nostra, is transparency. Like, maybe the humans aren't making the decisions, but it's critical the humans
have
the ability to audit them. Otherwise, things are going to go very dark. And I think about this, you know, again, like we've talked many times in the show, like, what is going to be the killer app in Nostra that really makes it pop off? And I you know, if I were going AI today, like really trying to build a company around this, I would be thinking a lot around, can you build that kind of an experience for, like you said, the next battle, right? Like whenever something gets like super hot, you've probably already lost the opportunity or the really big opportunity. And so that next battle, you know, it's like, if you can build this sort of like auditable, self-sovereign AI agent, you're probably going to build that in and on top of an environment that makes it easy to audit, easy to do things like rank the authenticity of information. So some stuff we talked about are like some of the articles I put out a while ago around trust rank and how to disrupt Google. That's one of the reasons I'm really bullish on, you know, still this web of trust stuff with Noster. And I've seen a couple other companies integrating. I forget the name of it now, but like the project that allows you to, you know, call as like a service various trust ranks and then, you know, apply your own. I think building that self-sovereign AI assistant for a sort of Noster Bitcoin world makes a lot of sense and a lot of people are doing
it. I have a question for you guys. In such a world with this audit system, or I could also frame it as like a going to a court, it feels to me like poor countries, poor societies, poor people within a rich society don't fare well, because there is a cost to going to court. There's a cost to doing an audit, and who's going to bear that cost? So I guess that's just a general issue with society today too. And you pay taxes and then you can get public defenders and stuff like that. But that would, it seems like we don't break free from that, because like if AI decides you're bad, you did something wrong, so you need to be penalized. And it may or may not do it. Like its explanation of why may be excellent or okay, or needs a lot of study. So then if humans get involved to look at that, if it takes time, it costs money for humans to do that, who's going to bear that cost? And if we're talking about a private company, like if a customer of that company, that a user of that company falls into the naughty bucket, that's actually different than a court system or some kind of civil or public or criminal activity. It's just simply that private company gets to decide.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case in particular, I feel like it would be very common to just be like, it's cheapest to just be like, especially if this customer isn't delivering us business value, just cut them out, ban them. And if the AI model is poorly tuned, then a lot of like innocent people can get screwed over that way.
So yeah, I think these are great points to be raising, and I wouldn't pretend to have like the full answer to all of them. I would say that I think the current system is very harsh on people who lack resources. And I think that has gotten worse over time versus better. It doesn't seem to be correcting. It seems to be like getting worse and more harsh. And so, I think one area I would be optimistic about is by making the ability to kind of explain or defend or prepare yourself for that, to make that process much cheaper, is like one way to empower people who have fewer resources to be able to sort of get, say, like a fair trial or whatever. But I think you're also kind of, I don't know if you're maybe not being explicit about it, but I think you're kind of making the case for like open data, open protocols for this. Because if you do have a corporation, like you look at like when Facebook was growing really fast, they would sort of make arbitrary decisions that weren't meant to be hurting or helping anybody in particular, but they just end up having these big impacts. They sort of, you know, it's like a giant kind of lumbering around and you accidentally step on things, and you don't do it out of like malice. You're just like, don't really care, don't really notice. And I think the more that you have a centralized corporation doing that, the more that you're kind of putting that, you know, like a whole legal justice system at risk. So I think you do need open protocols and, you know, open data and a lot more transparency kind of across all of society. And I think Bitcoin's just like a great foundation layer for that. But, you know, something like a Noster, you know, is a great example of how you can do more transparent open data. But I don't pretend to have like the answer for that. I mean, when you have AI is so expensive to train and to host and serve, and requires specialized hardware that's expensive. So I think effectively the way to win this is like everything needs to be a lot cheaper.
Yeah.
And I think it will get there, but.
Yeah. So two thoughts on that. One, in terms of the auditability, I mean, like, I don't know about the sort of the fair trial thing. That's an interesting question, but like, even if it's just the open protocols, which sort of host all of the AIs in the future, like in the same sense that most people that are like, even us, like that use Bitcoin have never, I mean, Steve, maybe you have like audited Bitcoin core code. But it's still a much better system because we do have the wizards. And like, I mean, the reality of the world is as long as it's open sourced, you know, even if you only have, you know, the 20, whatever, Greg Maxwell's and like super geniuses that for whatever reason are just like altruistic motivated that are actually out there auditing it, that's still such a better world because they can, you know, raise the
alarm. I think it's different though. I mean, I agree in that case, it's great. Mm. Like a piece of software that millions might run, you know, having even just one trusted independent expert review it delivers value to all millions of those people. Mm-hmm. But here, yes, you could have one trusted or a group of trusted experts look at a model, the weight, stuff like that. But they're not going to be able to look at that and be like, and it's not going to be able to relate to one particular outcome later. Whereas with like Bitcoin wallet software, it's a predictable outcome. I guess, yeah. I mean, maybe the difference is LLMs are not predictable. So.
Okay,
they're not deterministic, whereas Bitcoin wallets are deterministic.
But compared to like which neurons are firing inside Trump's head at any given moment, like that's the current state that we are dealing with. So, you know, not as a political statement, just like a human statement. It's kind of random and probabilistic. And so I'm not suggesting we have the full answers to this. I'm saying because it's probabilistic, the current thing that we've chosen to accept, we could move to a new system that's probabilistic and has its own problems, but is much more controllable.
I think there's a lot of interesting things that come out of this. Number one, I agree. And obviously it's much better. It feels much better to be able to say, okay, we've audited this like deterministic code. Although even in that, right, there still could be bugs that like, you know, slip past reviewer's eye for many years and you don't see where that goes. But I think there's two possibilities here. One is, yeah, we just have to sort of accept the complexity. It's never going to be perfect, but having things be audited is still, you know, you can get better and better over time, and more engineers looking at it will be able to figure out more relationships and still raise more fire alarms than not. So I think it's still a big move in the right direction. And, you know, to keep bringing up my Santa Fe Institute trip, the postdoc that I was chatting the most with, he actually has very interesting papers exactly on this question. And he talks about, not to get too nerdy, but like biology is the way to sort of break sort of the paradox of Gödel's incompleteness theorem, which is the idea effectively that like a member of a set can't be the entire set. And like his whole thing is like looking at this idea that, you know, we try and bring everything back to one-to-one mapping, but the reality of biology and, you know, any complex system is there is no one-to-one mapping. There's like, you know, N to M or M to N mapping, and that those things can always change. The relationships can change. But it doesn't mean we can't get like a little bit better at predicting what's going to happen or, you know, make progress on that front. So I think that's one thing. The second thing though, is I think we can also, you know, I think maybe there's a call here for the models themselves. Like you can make progress by saying, show us the weights, show us the system prompts that you're using to run the model. You know, you keep getting better and better at that. But then there's also at some point, I think a possibility of like, do we just somehow, I don't know, that this seems like it should be a government thing, but like maybe there's a, you know, a way to do this, but like literally open source the model and all of this training. And maybe this is actually going to come from someone that just like a, you know, a friendly whistleblower who just leaks all the data set. But like, the more we can see not just the weights, but like literally every piece of information a model was trained on, maybe that could happen one day on Nostr, the more that model becomes a little bit more trusted. So I think there's a lot of greenfield to figure out what to do to get better. At the same time, I think the reality though is exactly what you're saying. Like we also just have to accept in this new world, like determinism is over.
Yeah. Can we talk about the mysterious 80,000 Bitcoin transferred?
Yes.
You asked about that, David.
Tell us.
What did you see?
So I shared an article that a friend sent me that kind of took, you know, there's this like movement of 80,000 Bitcoin, and it kind of broke down a bunch of, you know, hypotheses or observations, or kind of it represented itself as if it was doing all this like field work around what, you know, what that meant and who it likely was and messages that were contained within the movement. And it seemed kind of like a reasonable analysis, but I have no idea if it was like legit or not. So like I'm not in the like verify phase. I was just in the like, okay, what is this thing? So I sent it to you and it sounds like maybe you were like, oh, this is kind of mostly nonsense.
Well, it came onto a lot of people's radar, I think, when the 80,000, it was 8-10,000 Bitcoin transactions moved all at the same time. I think blockchain history showed that all 8 were from the same wallet, that they were tied together. That's like $8 billion of Bitcoin.
Small amount.
So, and I think initially it was proposed that maybe that was Roger Ver had like an extra stash.
There was speculation there. Interestingly, at least one of the addresses were ones that Craig Wright claimed were his in prior legal proceedings. Wouldn't surprise me if one or more of them were from Mt. Gox, who knows? But but they definitely moved. If that's the whole story, it's not that big a deal. It could be Roger Ver, it could be an early miner. I think they're only one hop away from the Coinbase as well. So it either was the miner or whoever purchased it from the miner. And it never moved, it had only moved once. And these were coins from like 2010, I think. Maybe 2011.
I think 14 years had passed, they said. Because I think that was part
2011.
Part of the hypothesis in that article was that somebody was like kind of taking a precision assessment of these coins and using some sort of established case law about property that remains unclaimed for a certain amount of time, and then you can actually claim it as yours or something like that. I think that was a little bit of the setup of the article.
Anyway, if it was just that's the end of the story, we just move on. I mean, every 6 months, there's someone from that era who moves their coins and no big deal. But then another interesting wrinkle, and this article does mention this as well, is that each of those addresses also had Bitcoin or basically op return messages sent to those addresses with messages. And these messages were around the rightful legal owner of those coins. Mm-hmm. It had a web link to a Salomon Brothers website to fill out a form. And I forget all the other details, but it basically was putting the owner of those Bitcoin on notice that they need to move their Bitcoin or take action, fill out this form, move their Bitcoin, take actions to claim their Bitcoin. Otherwise, and it did say in these messages that someone has stepped up claiming they're the rightful owner of this Bitcoin. So that's ominous and scary. It turns out that it's not just those addresses receive these op return messages. Many addresses have been sort of blanketed or dusted with these op return messages. So one theory is that, someone spammed a bunch of Bitcoin addresses with this, and this particular owner got spooked and moved their Bitcoin as a response, basically as instructed.
To prove ownership and prove it's not abandoned property.
Yes. Now, there's other ways to prove you own the Bitcoin. You could sign a message as a response to their op return with the private key, and that would prove that you control the private keys and you wouldn't have had to transfer the Bitcoin. So, and that would be even... That would be definitive proof that you're responding to their message, because otherwise it could just be like completely independently these Bitcoin are transferred, unaware of this message or independent of the message.
Are these addresses somehow at bigger risk because they're old? Like the older,
they have a lot of Bitcoin
format? Sure, it's a large quantity, but like, is there something with the way the signature, is it P? 2SH or whatever, is there something to do with the format of the way Bitcoin used to be stored or the way these addresses hold it that put them at
no,
bigger
I
risk
think
of an exploit?
The ones that received the message, I think, just have a lot of Bitcoin.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, sorry, I haven't done nearly as much research, but my understanding was that these addresses, those really early ones, I guess, have like less randomness or entropy in the generation. And so, I mean, I didn't see this, you know, implied in the article, but like one crazy, and I'm not saying this is at all, you know, the case, but like, couldn't one also theory be like someone has a quantum computer and broke the ones with less entropy?
I mean, I saw that theory as well, but I'm not sure what you're referring to about less entropy.
Well, I assumed those earlier 2010, 2011 coins that the address type would be easier for a quantum computer to break than ones that came, I don't know, later on.
No, there's no addresses that have less entropy.
Interesting. I have to go back and recheck what I was
saying. I mean, sure, someone can generate an address with old types, new types, mm-hmm. in 2011 and 2025 that has weak entropy, but the technology available was not weaker then than it is now.
Interesting. So I have to go back and reread what the claim was, but there was some claim that, and I mean, isn't this understood that there are certain address types that are more prone, I guess, like, because we've changed.
Yeah. So both old and new.
Okay.
So maybe what you're referring to is pay to pub key.
Yeah, that could be it.
So that's nothing to do with entropy.
Entropy,
it's because pay to pub key doesn't hash.
Right. It exposes
the address
raw.
Yes.
Got
and
it.
So does Taproot.
Got it. Okay. So this is something hopefully we'll all learn a lot more about next week at the Quantum Summit. But were these coins that moved, were they raw pub key exposed, or do we know that?
I doubt they were. I think they were pay to pub key hash, but I'd have to go look to verify, but I don't think that, but I did see some theory that, you know, they were generated with weak entropy and, but not because of the address type, they just happened to be generated with weak entropy and were stolen. But okay, let's get to the more credible attack here is that it appears to be that there's another Craig Wright-like legal attack brewing. So I'm quite positive David is familiar with Solomon Brothers, but our younger brother Max here, have you heard of Solomon Brothers before?
I have seen The Big Short. That was pre Big Short. Oh shit. Okay, never mind. Wrong brothers, not Lehman Brothers, Solomon Brothers. I do remember the name. Yeah. But you'll have to catch me up on my
not Lehman Brothers, Solomon Brothers. They were a top five investment banking firm in the 80s.
Wow.
They were a very large, dominant Wall Street firm that got acquired in I think 2003. So prior to The Big Short. In any case, a few years ago, there was some kind of attempt to revive the brand. I don't know a lot about this history other than there's an attempt. I don't know if it's how it's going or who's behind it but there's, I saw that BitMEX Research went to this website that's included in these op return messages, which is a Solomon Brothers website. That lists a bunch of advisors of all these people who used to work for Solomon Brothers. And BitMEX Research reached out to all these people and got replies back saying that they confirmed that they are advisors of this company. So it at least confirmed that the website and at least some of the advisors are authentic. What's unknown is, but it's unclear if those people know that these op return messages were sent. But it could be the case that this new Solomon Brothers has a client who is saying, I own all of this Bitcoin and I'm hiring you to like go get it for me or something. I don't know. Pure speculation, but it raises the question that we now need to think about and worry about. Is there a new attack brewing on Bitcoin where people are going to, with a new legal ploy to try to like claim ownership of Bitcoin in which they are actually not the rightful owner. They don't have the private key.
All right. Two questions of that. One, did the, I guess, I don't know if this was published in the BitMEX thing, the people that said they are advisors to Solomon Brothers, did they know who is behind this? Or like, I mean, maybe they just wouldn't divulge, but like presumably someone like got them to sign a contract to be an advisor. Do we know who
that is? I don't know if they are asked. So they, I just know that they either are unaware of the message. I don't think they are asked. So yeah. It's unknown if they're aware or not aware.
And then the second question is, even if someone were doing this as like kind of like a strange legal attack, I mean, okay, say, you know, you come before, you say, this is my Bitcoin. It's been unclaimed for 14 years. A court or someone says, okay, fine, it's yours. But like, one, wouldn't you have some burden of proof to prove that you have the private key? And two, even if you did win some ruling from a court, if someone still has the private key, I mean, they own the Bitcoin, right? Like, that's, it's almost irrelevant.
I have no idea, but I do know that Craig Wright, in one of his lawsuits, was claiming a bunch of addresses were his, and he was asking the court, he claimed to the court the software developers, and he gave them a list of developers he claimed controlled Bitcoin, and it was, they had a fiduciary duty to change the software to give him his Bitcoin. And that court case got closed because he lost the COPPA court case, but it was not resolved. So someone who wished to attack Bitcoin again could pursue those lines, saying this list of people control Bitcoin. A court could order them to change the code to get them the Bitcoin. Now, we all know how that actually works in practice, even if these developers, to stay out of prison, wrote the code to reassign these Bitcoin to another person, that software is not going to be adopted. Although taking to the extreme, then the courts could issue this verdict to Coinbase and all the different companies in the space and say, you have to run the software. It's a court order. I mean, I'd like to see that play out. That would be totally absurd. I don't think that would survive.
But I'd like to see that play.
Yeah, I'll take this one.
At this point, I mean, just imagine that if a court really got to that point, it would make, there's a lot of vested interest in the price of Bitcoin now. So, and the price of Bitcoin goes to zero if that were to actually happen. So,
right. I wonder if part of this could be somebody trying to lay claim to early coins that they think would be abandoned in the future, if there's a future quantum exploit, that they sort of lay initial claim to those so that when, maybe it's a year from now, maybe it's 10 years from now, but when quantum finally becomes possible to break some of these addresses and you don't know like what happens to Satoshi's coins or whatever, well, maybe their answer is, well, I already have laid claim. I'm the first, you know, in line here.
That's an interesting thought. That could be the case. So I think this is one to keep paying attention to.
We should discuss more about this at the Quantum Summit too. I mean, one of the things I've been thinking about is, I mean, obviously we know some cryptography types are vulnerable to quantum. We say some are quantum resistant. I'm not an expert enough to know why we think that. But one thing that I am, I don't know, like curious about is, it is interesting this is all happening as AI, some would argue, is reaching some sort of singularity type point. I do wonder if there are risks we're not thinking through carefully enough with superintelligence hitting same time as quantum. And, you know, I don't know, like, I wonder what assumptions we have about the nature of cryptography. And like, you know, obviously we say, well, it's you know, it's easy to multiply, but difficult to divide. But in a world with superintelligence, who knows where that goes? And so, I don't know. I mean, this definitely gives me a little concern. It's a little weird.
When it comes to quantum, I'm still lean skeptic, because I mean, a quantum computer still has only demonstrated, I think it was like 11 years ago, could factor like 21, and now it can only, 11 years later, it can only factor 95. Or, I mean, it's just, I mean, I realize it's exponential growth, but.
Well, and not just exponential growth, I think maybe one more like, thought for researchers and people that are charting trends here is, we look at the quantum growth in a quote unquote modern day world, but we're not charting that with the help of superintelligence researchers around it. Again, I don't want to like raise any flags. I know nothing. Like, this is literally just me speculating right now. But something we should definitely chat about at the Quantum Summit as well is like those two factors overlapping. Because if you have super intelligent researchers, I mean, what can they plus quantum do? I have no idea.
Yeah, I look forward to learn a lot on Thursday or Friday.
It's a week from tomorrow?
Yeah.
Thursday, yeah.
And if people are in San Francisco and want to attend, can they still apply to get a ticket?
You'd have to ask.
You have to ask Mr. Alex here.
Alex, I'm sure he can hear us.
Yeah. What's the 411?
Yeah, what's the deal? Can we still attend the Quantum Summit if we haven't applied already?
There are a few spots left. You can apply at pbquantum.com.
pbquantum.com. Okay.
Interesting. Yeah. I can't wait to learn. But by the way, while we have Alex in the mic or in the headphones, I see we have a chat. Could you pull that up? I'm just curious who's been chatting with us. Please. Oh, thank you. Oh.
Well, that's the beginning. I think John's joined probably to hear about Skibidi, is my guess.
Oh, yeah. Actually,
John's from All Fun? Well,
I'm guessing it's John Spahari, but I don't know. But if it is John Spahari, he created Bolt.Fun, which where Mutiny was born and a lot of other is like a great hackathon. So my guess is it's him, and he was interested in hearing about Skibidi.
If it is, shout out to John's. Like what Bolt.Fun, I don't know if they've been operating recently, but those guys were the OGs. All of the early original Bitcoin application experimentation came out of the hard work that John's did. So that dude is a legend. If it is you, what's up, John's?
Yeah, what's up, John's? Back on the Skibidi topic, I did have prepped this screen share. So if you are watching this in video format, I wanted to at least share this, and we can kind of walk through and talk through some of what it is. But this is the first place winning prize for the Skibidi cash. And I did want to take a quick walk through, because I think it's cool. You know, it takes a very innovative approach to what a wallet should be. A winning wallet turns onboarding into an interactive game. Did you guys all see this video?
It's
4 minutes, so I'm not going to play the whole thing, but we'll just play like the beginning. You see like the toilet head. It's, you know, the Satoshi in a toilet, Skibidi Satoshi. And, you know, it's very like cartoon and animated, create wallet, ready for the mini game. And so you're walking through like a kind of a 2D type, you know, 3D looking environment, and you're like getting a key, and you lost, you need a secret passphrase, here's 12 words, you know, so sort of a game-like onboarding to the concept of a 12-word, private key, which is very different than almost any other wallet. You've got, you know, gifts here and cats, first enemy down, here's your first 6 words. So it turns what's ultimately like a very weird, confusing experience when people are like, why can't I just have an email and a password like I do for every other website? It sort of introduces people to the concepts of, you know, a 12-word phrase, you know, within this game context. You're sort of learning while you're having fun. So I just wanted to at least share that. You can see these rewards you get, Skibidi Bob. I mean, they did a really good job. I think this is great.
It's amazing. I mean,
they've really taken this
super
testnet as a playing card level hacker.
Oh, man.
Like they did. I mean, somebody really spent time to think through like a very, very different experience for how to onboard to a Bitcoin wallet. And I wanted to just sort of like, you know, give that a little bit of props and sort of, you know, get a chance to look through it together, because I think, you know, most people say, oh, Bitcoin wallets, they're already there. We already have them. It's not a business, whatever. Like, people have all kinds of preconceptions about Bitcoin wallets. I think a point Steve has always made is there's so many different ways to think about wallets and how you market them and how the feature set works and everything. And I think, you know, here we are, Bitcoin's been around 16 years or whatever. And here we are with like a totally innovative new approach to what a wallet should look like that feels more like a video game. Yeah. So I wanted to at least demo that and kind of
thanks.
Shout out to them.
Yeah, that's cool.
Agree, and thanks for demoing that. Let's maybe give a quick touch on the Pakistan Bitcoin mining and IMF real quick. I don't think there's a whole lot to say here, but there is a news story I think came out yesterday saying that the there's ambition. I mean, there's work being done right now within Pakistan to support Bitcoin mining for a lot of their and carve out a lot of their energy build out and direct it towards Bitcoin mining while it's not being used because there's no demand yet for it. It's much like Max wrote about 4 or 5 years ago. And we talked about when you do a big energy build out, you build it so that you can meet the demand over the next like 25 years and you don't have all that demand up front. So you have all this like dormant energy supply, and Bitcoin mining is an amazing economic vehicle. So that's exactly what Pakistan is hoping to do. And what they're learning from the IMF is IMF is not approving that. Or at least, they don't like that idea. And my understanding is that, it was specifically the terms crypto and Bitcoin were red flags because my understanding is that a phase one of this did get approved by IMF and they changed the terminology to just HPC.
Mm-hmm.
High performance HPC? Computing, high performance computing, like AI.
AI, yep.
So just compute. And then that got approved. And then now they're working on a phase two approval and it used the term crypto or Bitcoin and that did not get approved. It's also my understanding that it's not their decision to make really, but I could imagine it could impact future loans, et cetera. But just interesting to pay attention to that and compare that to El Salvador, because that's been an ongoing saga back and forth with the IMF or not. And Bitcoiners love to get riled up about how the IMF feels threatened or wants to squash Bitcoin, and I'm always trying to tease out like how true is that versus not, and like how much of it is specifically El Salvador or Bukele or their games or strategy versus IMF. So it's nice to have another country to compare to see what happens. But from what I see so far, it appears the IMF does have like, you know, crypto and Bitcoin are red flags. They don't like it and they want to squash it.
You don't say. The IMF really doesn't like Bitcoin.
Yep. I know we've only got a few minutes. We do have another topic from the title that we haven't spoken about, which I thought was kind of interesting. So I don't know if we can squeeze one in, but this Robinhood tokenized stocks product. Have you guys seen it, played with it, know much about it?
Just heard the headlines.
I was excited to buy OpenAI stock through it. And then OpenAI told me that it knows nothing about it, and it's not OpenAI stock. So I ran away.
So I think, you know, just for the setup here, I think what I understand is Robinhood had a big announcement of a new platform they were doing that was going to tokenize stocks, meaning a lot of people can't buy stocks through like a traditional brokerage account. And so if you can get a Robinhood account, you could buy something of like a token equivalent or a mirror type product of these underlying stocks. And I think they had gotten, I assume they had gotten some allocation in the private markets of things like SpaceX, I think was one of the ones, and OpenAI was another one. But when you're buying a token, you don't actually have the rights of ownership that you have when you buy equity through a traditional brokerage. So there's people out there thinking that they're going to be able to buy OpenAI stock. What they're really buying is tokens issued not by OpenAI, but tokens issued by Robinhood that's attempting to track OpenAI stock, but without OpenAI's agreement. And obviously, OpenAI can issue more shares, and that's going to dilute your tokens, just like you would if you were an equity holder, but you actually have like zero rights as a token holder. That's not even, the token wasn't even issued by the company. I mean, it'd be bad enough if the token were issued by the company and, you know, kind of in the way a lot of that nonsense happens. But here you actually have like a third party, you know, creating tokens that are not even agreed to be created by the equity issuer. So I think you kind of have no rights and the kind of code is law.
What's the world?
Narrative is just, yeah, what could possibly go wrong? So I think OpenAI came out and said, this is not us. We don't honor these. This is just, you know, nonsense. Is that kind of the state of things? Is anybody, did Robinhood come back and say anything about why it's actually good or why they think they actually have some claim here?
I didn't see a response. It's also interesting to analyze this both for public stocks and private stocks. Because like SpaceX and OpenAI are examples of privately held ones. Historically, we've had secondary markets giving some people access to that, but it's always been pretty limited and a lot of friction. So, you know, if this works, it would like massively reduce friction for any user. Or so for the few people who had access to these systems in the past, it would like be a way better UX, and you'd expand it to everyone in the world could access it. So that's super powerful. And for public stocks, a lot more people have access to that, and it's pretty frictionless these days for those people. But there's a whole lot of people in the world who don't have access to even public stocks. So this platform from Robinhood could open up access to that. But it has all the problems you mentioned, or trade-offs. The thing is, though, that might be worth the risk to a lot of people. If you don't have access and you want exposure into these high upside opportunities, if there's a 10, 20, even 50% chance it just disappears due to these risks, it actually might be a financially logical move or rational move to make. So I could see it being successful even with a purely rational thinking. But it'll also be interesting to see how it's regulated.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like I wonder if it's legal at all. So I'm curious how that goes. But I mean, it reminds me of like Abra back in the day had these synthetic, you know, ideas of like contracts for difference. And it certainly makes sense, like for both public and private equities, there's a huge market around the world that can't access them, that even if you create a synthetic position, you say you're going to track it, like there's going to be demand for it. So I don't know if that's what they're doing, but the synthetic position idea is very interesting to me. But it's like the same idea of like, do I have the raw Tether token or a contract for difference to create a synthetic dollar, different set of risks. And to me, it just sounds kind of like illegal. So, I mean, I'm not a legal expert. I don't know, but I'd be careful.
All right.
I think so that's what OpenAI said. OpenAI said, be careful.
Be careful. Was that the intelligence talking? Did they have an LLM generate their
press release? Exactly. That's okay. Cool.
All right.
It's time to wrap. Let's do it.
Good to see you guys. Until next time.
Bye, everyone.
Later on.